Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. A sculpture called Carbon Sink, which was installed on the University of Wyoming campus, has generated a lot of controversy in the past couple of years. It was a pinwheel of charred logs that sought to draw a connection between coal, global warming, and increased beetle kill. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports that this supposedly anti-carbon message certainly got the attention of lawmakers, donors, and those in industry.
The piece was installed in 2011 and was removed in May of 2012, a year earlier than expected. After Carbon Sink's removal, UW professor Jeff Lockwood wrote a scathing piece accusing the university of buckling to political pressure. So we requested records from UW to see if there was any truth to that. We got a large stack of printouts and a thumb drive filled with hundreds of emails and documents pertaining to the sculpture. Some were from industry reps, others were from legislators. One of those was from Gillette Representative Greg Blickery, as read by a WPR staff member.
I just read the Casper Star Tribune story on the front page about the artist hired by the university to produce a product that trashes the very industries that provide nearly all the income in Wyoming for the state and for the university.
Laramie Representative Kermit Brown wrote that it almost seems to mandate that we have a second four-year school in the state oriented toward the interest of those who make the state successful, meaning the energy industry. Gillette Representative Tom Lubnow, who serves in the powerful post as House Majority Floor Leader, wrote, quote, "I am considering introducing legislation to avoid any hypocrisy at UW by ensuring that no fossil fuel-derived tax dollars find their way into the University of Wyoming funding stream."
As soon as I hit the send button on that one, I called and said, throw that one away, I'm going to send you another one.
The records we obtained didn't turn up the new statement, but in his public statements and future correspondences, Representative Lubnow said he would never tinker with the university's funding stream. The university and the Legislative Service Office said it's very hard to come up with an exact number for how much of the university's budget comes directly or indirectly from Wyoming's coal mines and oil and gas fields. But 60% of UW's budget seemed a fair low bracket estimate. And so Representative Lubnow wanted to take advantage of a teachable moment.
Whether you appreciate that or not, and whether you like that or not, between 60 and 80% of your budget comes from those extractive industries, and it's something you ought to know.
Peabody Energy wrote and said their $2 million donation to UW was in question. And president of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming, Bruce Hinchey, had his own teachable moment when he wrote to a who's who list of Wyoming industry, quote, "The next time the University of Wyoming is asking for donations, it might be helpful to remind them of this and other things they have done to the industries that feed them before you donate," end quote. Chris Boswell, UW Vice President for Governmental and Community Affairs, was working for Governor Mead at the time.
Carbon Sink did come up, and frequently not in the sort of formal channels.
In other words, the documents we received were just the tip of the iceberg.
As it turned out, that installation played a role in budget decisions in the Appropriations Committee. As an example, Governor Mead had proposed a $2 million appropriation for the Cultural Trust Fund. If you go back and listen to what occurred, there was a very simple motion to delete the $2 million from the governor's budget, and it passed without discussion. What that tells you is that there had been plenty of discussion.
To be clear, the Cultural Trust Fund helped fund a portion of the Carbon Sink. Governor Mead said he wasn't crazy about Carbon Sink either, but he tried to mitigate.
To the angry one, I said, listen, we can like or not like that, but I think that we have to recognize that these things can happen at a university. And if you talk to President Buchanan directly, he certainly has a great appreciation for what energy means to the university.
So to the question of was there pressure to get rid of Carbon Sink, the answer seems to be yes. And the question of whether UW caved to that pressure, abandoning its right of free speech and academic freedom, here's Chris Boswell again.
It is in the university's interest to be mindful of the factors at work in making determinations in the state capitol. But, you know, angry folks don't get to call the shots at the university. The university would be crazy to disregard constituencies completely. But at the same time, the university cannot kowtow to them. It's a balancing act.
Nevertheless, the documents do reveal that the sculpture was originally scheduled to be removed next summer, 2013. But an email from President Buchanan to Art Museum Director Susan Moldenhauer said, quote, "Given the controversy that it has generated, it would be best for UW if the carbon sink could be considered part of the Prexy's removal during the summer of 2012. The piece was removed in May. Here's Susan Moldenhauer.
I don't know what his reasoning was. There was no conversation, so I don't really know why. My only thought was that his request was in the best interest of the institution, and I had to consider that and reply to that. My feeling was it was not part of the pressure or whatever was going on, but I don't know.
As an aside, Moldenhauer says the museum did see a slight decrease in donations. One of the reasons the university gave for its early removal was the flooding of the piece due to a sprinkler line break. But that happened after President Buchanan's email. Buchanan did not want to comment for this story, but once again, here's Chris Boswell.
I think the president was recognizing that the university had gone through quite a bit as a result of this installation. It had been damaged, and is there any merit in thinking about removing it in 2012?
When the legislature approved the half-acre recreation center renovations on campus, lawmakers stuck in language requiring that artwork in the gym must get approved by the governor and address transportation, agriculture, and minerals in Wyoming's history. It's a symbolic gesture with food for thought. For one, Governor Meade doesn't feel terribly qualified to approve or not approve artwork. But here's Representative Lubnow's take.
I think that everybody who has a stake at the University of Wyoming should have the opportunity to have a say in what that university looks like for our citizens. And what better body than the mirror of the people of the state of Wyoming through the 90 people who are elected by the people of the state of Wyoming to have input.
So the question now is, where does that input stop and the state's only university's autonomy begin? For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, I'll talk forest fires and bark beetles with a federal official, and our old friend Kristen Espeland-Gourlay has a story on climate change and the elderly. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
I'm Bob Beck. Bark beetles and forest fires continue to grab the attention of Wyomingites. In fact, many believe that climate change is behind both problems. Butch Blazer is the Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We sat down with him as he visited with regional foresters in Cheyenne last week. Blazer says beetle kill remains a serious problem in the Rocky Mountain West.
Right now, in this particular area, we're looking at about 1.8 million acres that have been impacted, with about 1.4 million of those acres impacted by the mountain pine beetle. And, you know, this has been coming on for quite some time. And in the year 2007, the decision, because of the major impact that we were starting to see, the decision was made to handle it as a major incident, and to handle it by assigning a incident command team, much like we do a catastrophic wildfire. We assigned an incident command team to handle this bark beetle situation. And as it's turned out, it's worked out very well. The incident commander, in working with all of our partners that are being impacted by this epidemic, have come together and have done a very good job at utilizing the resources at hand to address this epidemic.
Would you talk and inform listeners about some of the strategies you've employed, some of the things that you're doing?
Basically, the strategy outlines how to address three major areas. And those particular areas are safety, recovery of the land, of the acres, and restoring the resiliency to those impacted areas. And of those three, safety is by far the major area that is looked at as the priority to try and ensure that people and community infrastructure are protected from the hazards from these bark beetle kill trees.
Obviously, one of the things you've been keeping yourself busy with this summer is putting out fires. And there have been fires, obviously, throughout Wyoming, throughout Colorado in the West, some very high-profile fires. I guess as you're looking at how that process has gone and battling them, what's your assessment so far? And are there any plans in the future that might change things?
Well, again, you know, it just appears that our wildfires are getting more intense. You know, how that relates to a warming climate. I think there's several factors involved here. But again, we're seeing more and more of these catastrophic situations that makes it imperative that we all come together in a very strategic way and have the discussions we need to have to figure out how to address these wildfires.
I'm interested in something else that appears to be happening with the Forest Service. We ran into researchers in a couple of these fires who have gone in after the fact and looking at a lot of things, you know, vegetation impacts, soil impacts, and certainly impacts on wildlife as well. Is that something that's really picked up, and what do you hope to do with that information?
Oh, that it has picked up. It's extremely important because, again, as we have seen these wildfires become more intense, we need to understand how that intensity is impacting the landscapes as we have these burns occur. And so this science, this improved information and data as a result of these catastrophic wildfire situations is extremely important to us, and it's something that we're going to continue to do.
I know there's a lot of discussion on the way fires are attacked. I think in the old days you'd let a lot of fires burn, but with more folks up there, there is more of an aggressive approach to try and, I guess, put them out, but that can be expensive. How are you guys weighing that and talking about that in Washington? What kind of insight can you give us on this very difficult, challenging issue?
Well, again, something that we're going to continue to build on in the future is a very aggressive approach to wildfire starts, trying to get on top of these fires before they get rolling. And we've had a pretty good percentage rate of being able to do that. And so we want to continue to work on that and to improve upon it. But again, you know, the situations that we have out in our forest, not only our federal forest, but in our forests across the country, that we really do need to work together in a very aggressive way in figuring out how to do the accelerated restoration that we're starting to do on our national forests. The state agencies, through their statewide forest action plans, are looking at identifying priority areas in critical watersheds where they can work with state agencies, work with private landowners. But the key is to do that accelerated restoration across the landscapes.
Deputy Undersecretary Blazer, a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. The job you do is extremely important. Thank you.
When you think of climate change, you might think of forest fires or heat waves. You might not think of respiratory disease, cardiac arrest, or viruses. As former Open Spaces co-host and the current health reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio, Kristen Espelin-Gourlay, discovers, doctors and scientists are beginning to focus attention on the most vulnerable to these ailments, the elderly.
When you think of climate change, you might think of melting ice shelves, heat waves, shrinking habitat for animals and plants. You might not think of respiratory disease, cardiac arrest, tropical viruses. But scientists and government agencies are beginning to report new information about the ways in which the environmental damage humans have caused could damage human health. And the elderly, who already face a greater risk of certain health problems, are particularly vulnerable. Kathy Sykes directs the Environmental Protection Agency's Aging Initiative, a relatively new effort for the EPA. She says older people are more likely to have chronic conditions like diabetes or heart disease.
Air pollution can exacerbate those conditions and lead to premature deaths and trips to the hospital and lots more medications.
When it comes to environmental health, EPA first focused on children, but more recently the agency realized another vulnerable population, seniors, would be disproportionately affected as well. And that demographic wave is about to crest. Kentucky's Department of Aging estimates that the number of people 60 and older in Jefferson County will make up more than a quarter of the total population by the year 2030. Are we ready for the public health challenge?
A large majority of the public health directors we spoke with felt that they did, in fact, lack the resources, the staff, the funding, and the expertise to be fully prepared.
Environmental Defense Fund's Kathy Molina helped conduct this first-of-its-kind survey of public health departments' readiness for climate change. The issue is just now grabbing more of the spotlight on Capitol Hill, and scientists are also charting new territory to find answers to questions about how precisely environmental forces might make us sick. University of Louisville Dr. Aruni Bhatnagar is pioneering the new field of environmental cardiology. He describes a Harvard study of six major U.S. cities in which researchers found, not surprisingly, that the cities with the highest levels of pollution had the lowest life expectancy.
What was a surprising outcome was in the subsequent studies, and which showed that about 70 to 80% of these deaths were cardiac deaths. Now, that was totally unanticipated because we had no understanding, leave alone a mechanism, that could link exposure to pollutants to heart disease or has been ever done before.
He says it's well known that older people are more susceptible to pollution. But add to that the fact that climate change could intensify pollution concentrations and that increased temperatures can fuel the creation of ground-level ozone, which comes from engine exhaust. So Bhatnagar and his colleagues are investigating the effects of a family of chemicals found in car exhaust and air pollution on heart conditions. We may not be able to alter the basic facts of a changing climate and the compounding effects of pollution. And we can't stop the aging process, yet. But the elderly don't necessarily have to look forward to pure doom and gloom. EPA Aging Initiative head Kathy Sykes says, for one thing, we can design communities that are healthier, pedestrian-friendly communities with fewer cars.
This really is the wave of the future. I think it's been understood more and more that personal behaviors are important, but how we can engineer back in people's lives, physical activity, walking places, will have a huge impact from a health standpoint.
That kind of planning could not only give seniors more quality years, it could also ease the climate change burden for the next generation. I'm Kristen Espeland.
Coming up, we learn about a new performance assessment that should help student teachers. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. University of Wyoming College of Education students will now be part of a comprehensive teacher performance assessment that will determine the student teacher's performance in a variety of skills. UW was among the institutions that helped develop the assessment that's called EdTPA. Some states already require teachers to pass an assessment like this to get licensed. That's not the case in Wyoming, but the College of Education will require the assessment to help develop better teachers. Bob Beck reports.
UW Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies Alan Trent says student teachers must show proficiency in a number of areas.
This assessment largely asks teachers to plan a series of lessons, to teach those lessons, videotape a part of that teaching, assess the student's work, and then give the students, you know, actual feedback. Are you telling your students the kinds of things that supports their continued learning? And then to really take a step back and reflect on all that.
Trent says it might sound simple, but it's a very involved process that takes a lot of time. The students have to follow a booklet that is very specific. UW and school districts have done a good job of monitoring and providing feedback to student teachers for many years. But Trent says this goes a bit further.
One of the major differences is it doesn't just assess your knowledge of things about teaching. It assesses whether or not you can actually perform those skills and use that knowledge and make it applicable to student learning.
Andrea Burrows teaches science education in the college. She says it really forces students to pay close attention to all aspects of what goes on in the classroom.
How you are taking what you know about your content area and transferring that to students. And sometimes students don't pay enough attention to that particular area, and there's a whole area in the TPA that's devoted to that.
Burrow says student teachers are taught to closely look at whether students are meeting the standards and goals required in today's teaching environment, but she believes the TPA forced them to reflect on that more than maybe they've done in the past. A former student who's currently an elementary teacher in Cheyenne agrees. Jordan Christopoulos used the TPA during her student teaching last spring, and she says it helped her with class planning and whether students were getting what they needed.
I think it was very beneficial to sort of reflect on my teaching and reflect on every aspect of teaching a lesson. You know, I think the questions were very helpful in the sense that they really got me to sit down and think, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, what would I change? They really got down to the nitty-gritty, the specific questions to really help assess my teaching.
This is good news for College of Education faculty member Diana Wigg, who evaluates national EdTPA scores on elementary math teaching. She says UW education students typically are ready to teach and do well when they graduate. But she noted that the EdTPA forced students to prepare more than they had in the past.
One of the unintended consequences I got when I went in to observe students was I got an incredibly comprehensive lesson plan for me to follow. So it made them think more deeply, in their words, about what they were doing, and it extended beyond just that little part of the student teaching TPA part into basically the whole semester.
Dean of Undergraduate Studies Alan Trent says UW students will all get the teacher performance assessment this spring. And while it's useful to prepare students to teach in the real world, he says when the college gets the scored results, they'll be able to determine how they as a college are doing.
Do we have really strengths in our program that we want to continue to reinforce? And does the data tell us, hey, our students seem to be weak in these areas? That'll allow us to change our own curriculum.
Trent expects this type of assessment will prepare the soon-to-be teachers for other performance assessments they'll face later in their careers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
The Sinclair Refinery near Rawlins has had four fires or explosions since May, and Wyoming's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, has been investigating what went wrong. OSHA has completed its investigation into one of the incidents. It was a fire on May 25th, which injured two workers. Wyoming OSHA Administrator John Eisbart joins us to talk about what they found. He says one of the main problems is that Sinclair wasn't properly training its workers.
They have had a significant amount of turnover at the plant of their operators, which is the basic position in the plant. They've had about a 50% turnover in the last, I believe it's about 18 months. And so they have a lot of new operators, and they haven't all been trained adequately. In addition to that, you have some aging equipment and infrastructure, you know, plant and equipment. And as well, they had some managers and supervisors that didn't oversee it adequately and themselves that weren't trained.
And so as a result, OSHA, you guys came up with 11 citations against Sinclair. What's the upshot? What's the penalty that they have to deal with now?
The proposed penalty is $60,250. And the penalty really isn't the piece to focus on. What the penalty does is allows us to get them to the table to really negotiate on the mitigation of those infractions. For instance, we'll reduce some of the fines if they'll put in place a proper training program by a certain date, if they'll perform the proper inspections of that equipment by a certain date, those sorts of things.
And you've asked for them to bring in an external safety auditor as well and to have frequent meetings with OSHA.
Yes, and that's, Willow, that's in addition to all of those citations. We've really asked them to take a whole different approach to safety. What they have is they have a number of inspectors and consultants in place at the refinery. And each one looks at a little microcosm of the refinery. But what we found was that nobody was looking at the refinery overall. And if I can use an analogy, if you take a vehicle, if somebody that looks at the carburetor and says, yep, that carburetor is good to go, it's mechanically perfect, but the carburetor's not sized to the engine, and the engine may run fine, but it's leaking a whole bunch of oil. And so you need somebody that can come in and look at it all together, how it all works and functions together, and sign off and say, yes, each one of these processes is working appropriate itself, as well as in conjunction with everything else in the refinery.
And so that's what this external auditor is supposed to do.
Yes.
And obviously, this so far we're talking about one particular incident. Obviously, there have been several this year, and you guys are investigating all of them. And I understand you don't have final results from those other incidents yet. But based on what you know so far, what do you think was going on with some of these other fires and explosions?
You know, the one that injured the three people critically, that one. It is an ongoing investigation, and I hate to talk about that one, Will, because it's, again, it's an ongoing investigation, and we just don't want to jeopardize any of the critical components. But it does seem to be a lot of the same issues, that it's from the leadership aspect to the management oversight, the familiarity with the processes and procedures, and training.
If this is all sort of similar issues, and if the issue here really seems to be a lot of workers not having the training or not having the experience they need to be able to operate things properly and safely, I mean, shouldn't we be thinking about shutting the plant down for a little while those workers can be trained properly?
You know, I do believe they have enough trained people to run it safely. What I worry about and what the focus has been is about the distribution, getting those people on the right shifts and in the right places that match their experience and training. The issue of shutting the plant down was certainly discussed, and really the Sinclair management made it very clear that we have their attention, that they are going to be good partners in this, that they're really going to be proceeding forth in good faith. And so before we get to the drastic measures, that's why we're putting those other very severe restrictions and safeguards in place.
Obviously, this is a plant, as we've talked about, that's had various problems, you know, multiple fires and explosions and things like that. How will you know if the company has actually fixed the problems and taken the measures necessary to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Willow, what we've done, and that's a great question, that really has been paramount in our minds and thoughts as well. What we've done is we've significantly increased our exposure at the plant. And with the last incident that we had just in August, we asked the Fed OSHA component there. They are located in Utah, and they have some experts there in refining. And so they sent a team out to help us with that. They've been on site. I believe they were there for 10 days, gave us some great recommendations. And so with our increased presence at the plant and then bringing the Fed OSHA component back, I do believe that that's a good and adequate response at this point.
John Eisbart with OSHA, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Changing gears, the Cheyenne Concert Association started in 1935 as a way to bring a variety of music to the community. Funding for the association comes from the Arts Council, the National Endowment for the Arts, and other organizations. Mary Cox with the Concert Association tells us that their new season begins October 16th at the Cheyenne School Administration Building with the group New Odyssey.
What they advertise these people as is three guys, 30 instruments. So they play accordions. I didn't see a harpsichord on there, but I bet you there's something like that. There's several keyboards. There's trumpets, cornets, tubas, probably flutes, you name it, banjos, guitars, drums, you name it, they're all on there. And again, this is a group that's been together for 20 years, so they're very comfortable with each other. They do a comedy act and apparently also change costumes and do that type of thing. You can see them on YouTube, and I went on, the man put on a jacket, and then he hit the jacket in different spots, and it had different types of drums that would go off, and that looked real fun. So I think it'll be a real upbeat concert, and I think we'll enjoy ourselves.
Now, is the goal to try and bring different types of music every year?
Yes.
So in every concert?
In the old days, before we had the Cheyenne Symphony performing at the Civic Center or whatever, we would be down at the McCormick Junior High Auditorium, which is now the state office building, the Emerson Building. And I remember going down there with my mother many a time and, you know, wandering in there and stuff. So they just try to use wherever they are able to. They try to go more for smaller areas, not so huge as the Civic Center, so that it can be more intimate and people do know each other and get to know each other by attending over the years.
Well, we talked about New Odyssey. Do you want to run through the rest of the year schedule for us?
Yes, that would be great. We have New Odyssey coming on Tuesday, October 16th, and that will be at the School Administration Building, which is at 2810 House Avenue here in Cheyenne. Then in November, on the 20th, we have a group called Feast Celtic Fire. Apparently there are many Celtic fires, but this is Feast. And this is a group of smaller kind of performers that do the Irish types of songs, and then they have the woman and man that do the Irish dancing. So, you know, all that light, neat kind of dancing that they do. That will be at the new Cheyenne Central High School Auditorium. Then we go back to Ilya Yakushchev, who will be in March, on the 18th of March. It's a Monday. And that will go back to the School Administration Building again. We're going back and forth this year, trying not to confuse people, but it's a problem with scheduling, apparently, for some of these different auditoriums. So Ilya was here last year in September with the Cheyenne Symphony, so many people will remember him for that. And that's kind of fun, too, when you get to see one of the performers that had been here 2 years ago is down in Denver at one of the symphonies down there. And at a big symphony, he's not doing Cheyenne or the Concert Association. He's doing an actual symphony type of thing down there. And then the last performance will be on April 9th, which is another Tuesday, and it's a man and woman who are similar to Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and they are called Two on Tap, and they love how Broadway used to be, and they do a lot of pretty costume changes and lots of dancing, and again, try to bond with the audience, talk to people, have the comedy performance and that type of thing.
If people want to learn more about the association, how can they get that information?
They are able to go to CheyenneConcert.com. The tickets are ever so reasonable. For one adult, it is $55 for four concerts. For students, it's $25 per the membership. If you wanted to go for a whole family, up to three children and two adults, it's $130. There are also individual tickets that are allowed to be sold, and they're $20 for adults per concert and $10 for students. So it's a real deal. It's pretty neat.
Once again, the website is CheyenneConcert.com. Mary Cox, a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Bob. Hope to talk to you again.
Coming up, we'll have a discussion with a former state lawmaker who says the state should expand Medicaid. And I'll have a story about making buildings more energy efficient. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. As you may have heard, Governor Matt Mead is struggling with whether to recommend that the state expand Medicaid offerings. It would provide federal insurance to more people in the state, and supporters say it would save the state healthcare dollars in the long run. But the governor says it also could cost the state millions of dollars in upfront costs. Former State Representative Pete Jorgensen, a Democrat from Jackson, says the long-term benefits of an expansion make it worth it. Jorgensen was a longtime member of the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee and is pushing state health officials to go ahead with the Medicaid expansion. He joins me to discuss it. We've heard people say that this is going to be potentially very costly for the state. First off, is that accurate as far as the numbers you've looked at, that Wyoming in that six-year period might have to kick in a lot of money?
Bob, I'll give you my opinion, and it's based on 8 years on the Appropriations Committee and seriously trying to follow the health care issue while I was in the legislature and since. And two things stand out. When you talk about Medicaid, first place, most people don't know the difference between Medicaid and Medicare unless they're on one or the other. Medicaid is a 50-50 deal with the federal government for people of limited means. One of the most impressive things, well, actually it was depressive to me, the last day of the last session I was in, we were debating the expansion of KidCare in the House. I was speaking to the issue. The speaker got down from his podium, went to his desk, got recognized, and made a very concise statement. The market will take care of health care in Wyoming. And I just don't believe that. I see no evidence that we have a competitive life or health insurance policy or offerings in the state of Wyoming. That's the first thing. So if you're not willing to address the kid issue, which everybody says is foremost in their mind, you can hardly expect them to go along with doing it for adults who should be pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Every year, we would allocate a $40 or $50 million increment to the auditor's office to cover expected, not desirable, but expected increases in the second year of the biennium. Nobody liked to do that, but we were stuck with a system where there's a lot of cost shifting. And one of the issues in the ACA is to try and address this cost shifting, because until you can identify how the costs are covered and how they're now shifted to private insurance premiums or absorbed by the hospitals or by the state in payments to hospitals to make up for losses, you're never going to get a handle on the issue. And that's demonstrated worldwide in developed countries whose costs per person are less than half. They average half of ours. So to me, expansion of Medicaid, which is a program we have a part in together with the federal government to cover more of those under or uninsured people, is a logical thing to do, particularly when at the initiation of it, we don't pay anything. The feds pay 100%. After 5 years or whatever, we may pay up to 90% or 90%, no lower than that. That's a hell of a deal. And for us to accept numbers which question that is hard for me to understand.
Do we have a number of our citizens who aren't getting Medicaid or whatever and end up going to the emergency room when something catastrophic finally happens or when they get very seriously ill? Is there an interest for the state to get people out of the emergency room?
I think there is. Now, there are always going to be folks, whether they're on Medicaid or not, who are going to go to the ER because they don't have a family home or whatever they call it, medical home.
Or a doctor.
An individual doctor, right. Yeah. So that's the default option. And the thing about emergency rooms is you have to be served. We don't see people dying in the gutter, at least not very often. And that's certainly an obligation of the state ultimately because the state ends up paying and people with health insurance end up paying higher premiums because hospitals don't go broke as a rule and doctors don't go broke as a rule. There are a few specialties which are very high cost and those are treating conditions that can be caught at an early stage even by an ER if the patient is willing to follow the medications and make some life changes. I mean, the fact that McDonald's is going to start posting calories is a big step forward because we have problems. We know how to resolve them, and there's much more acceptance of dealing with them than there used to be.
You're an interesting person to talk to because, again, as we mentioned in the introduction, you've been on the Appropriations Committee when you were in the legislature for a number of years, and so you've struggled with this, and you've seen the Medicaid costs go up in the state. What generally has caused those rate increases? Is there something that could be done internally so if you do an expansion, you don't get hit with huge dollars like the state's worried about?
I don't think there's much more that well-meaning folks in the Department of Health can do until we deal with this underinsured and uninsured element of the population.
But they wouldn't get on what you and I might see, normal insurance. They would still be on Medicaid. And again, if you do the expansion, you're going to get more folks probably there as opposed to somewhere else, right?
Sure. The point is, the underlying point of health coverage population-wise is that until you've covered everyone, you can't identify what's really causing your cost increases in a population group. So the important things of having people in Medicaid are you can identify those three chronic issues early on and develop programs to try and deal with them, try to motivate the person to deal with it. And you're going to have some success. And you're going to cut down by demonstrable data on the use of ERs as a first diagnosis, if you will. People are getting smarter on the issues. McDonald's is getting smarter. God, that's not as good as Apple stock, but it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I think there are trends that are reassuring, and we need to get with the program.
So the state has been trotting out some numbers that they're concerned about could be, you know, this in this six-year period, anywhere from 50-some million to maybe even higher than that. Is the argument to be made that, okay, that's a hit, but long-term costs are better?
I believe so. I think that's a hit that we should be able to accommodate and accept and, in fact, appreciate the fact that someone else, although we may doubt their resolve to stay with the program, is picking up 90% of the money. Of the cost. That's an acknowledgement that we're not just a state by ourselves. We're a country. And we sometimes hesitate to do that. And I think in healthcare we need to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm. And again, so overall, short-term answer, a concern. But long-term, this is probably the way to go.
I believe so, yes. Get cooperating better.
And so you want to see us not just embrace the expansion, but embrace as much of the ACA as possible.
Absolutely.
Pete Jorgensen, he is a former longtime representative from Jackson. Always nice having you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Over the past few years, a growing number of people in Wyoming have been constructing buildings with an eye towards making them more energy efficient. But Wyoming still lags behind the rest of the country when it comes to green building. Willow Belden has the story.
Davy Jackson Elementary School is one of Wyoming's most environmentally friendly buildings. It's highly insulated, has triple-paned windows to retain heat, it's outfitted with water-saving toilets, and the carpeting is even made from recycled materials. Facilities Director Kevin Tebow shows me into a classroom. Sunshine pours in through a wall of windows.
The lighting in here automatically will reduce in output as the day gets brighter. So it takes the electrical demand off and is using natural light.
Other parts of the building use a fancy type of skylight to reduce the need for regular electric lights. Tebow says building an energy-efficient school was the right thing to do for environmental reasons.
I guess I could best be described as a redneck with a green stripe down me.
But the green features also save the school district money, at least in the long run. Tebow says it costs $1,000 a month to heat and light Davy Jackson Elementary, which breaks down to just 17 cents per square foot. He says utility bills for other schools in the district are way higher.
So I have a building, it's an elementary school. It's almost at $2 a square foot to heat and light that thing. If you compare apples to apples, 17 cents versus almost $2 a square foot. Big difference, isn't it?
The school got what's known as LEED certification, which means it met national standards for being environmentally friendly. Across the state, more and more buildings are meeting those same standards. 7 years ago, there were no LEED buildings in Wyoming. Now there are about 40, and many more are in the works. Brendan Schulte heads the Wyoming chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council, which is the organization that oversees LEED certification. He says interest is definitely growing.
I just had that last week. I had someone who they were buying a lot, and they saw that I was a LEED AP and asked me, can you talk to me about building my house more sustainably? I said, absolutely. 3 years ago, that didn't happen.
Schulte says the cost of building green is also going down because materials and technologies are becoming more mainstream. He says the payback period on a LEED certified home could be as little as 5 years. After that, you're saving money and helping the planet. It's hard to say exactly how much green building cuts down on greenhouse gases, but it can be significant. One example is the University of Wyoming. Since 2007, UW has been making its new buildings more energy efficient, and several have LEED certification. As a result, even though the university is growing, its overall carbon footprint has shrunk. Director of Facilities Planning Roger Ballman says that's good PR.
You know, students are starting to look for colleges and universities that are conservation conscious, I'll say that.
But Wyoming is still behind the rest of the country when it comes to green building. Brendan Schulte with the U.S. Green Building Council says one reason is that electricity here is cheap, so it takes longer to realize the financial benefits. He says another reason that green building has been slow to catch on has to do with a general Wyoming mentality.
Wyoming is a resource state, so there's a little bit of opposition to green building because I think there's a perception that green building is out to get fossil fuels.
And finally, there are logistical hurdles. Specialists in green technologies aren't always available locally. At Davy Jackson Elementary, they had to bring in someone from California to do the lighting system. And to get LEED certification, there are lots of hoops to jump through. Stephen Grimshaw is a developer who constructed Wyoming's first LEED apartment buildings in Casper. He had to pay for a LEED inspector to come all the way from Boulder, Colorado, multiple times during the construction process. And there was a mountain of paperwork.
The documentation process is extremely cumbersome. And, you know, we've got a year's worth of one person's labor involved in just the documentation.
Grimshaw says he's delighted to have built a sustainable building and plans to do future green projects, but he won't try to get them LEED certified. Then again, a building can be just as green without having the LEED seal of approval. Advocates say the other roadblocks to green building in Wyoming aren't insurmountable either. Milton Geiger is an energy extension coordinator at UW. He says, sure, if buildings use less energy, demand for things like natural gas might decrease slightly. But he says that's unlikely to hurt the industry and shouldn't drive decision making.
It'd be akin to say, well, if Wyoming wanted to stimulate its economy, everybody should leave their windows open all winter. I mean, it'd be the same type of thing, saying, let's just burn more energy and not burn it wisely.
Geiger says he expects green building to grow quickly in Wyoming as people become more aware of the long-term cost savings.
It is a logical economic decision. It doesn't need to be sold as, okay, it's for sustainability or other environmental concerns or whatever. It can just be, hey, I reduced my costs and it was an appropriate investment of capital.
And when you put it like that, he says, green building should become very popular in a state like Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you want to hear particular segments or the entire show again, you may go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. There, you may also sign up for our podcast, comment on stories, and suggest future stories. Tara Orr is our web editor.
You can follow all of our reporters on Twitter, and we invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page. We'll be back next week and feature conversations with two U.S. House candidates. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.